All right. The marshal can open court for us then.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Frisch, Judge Smith, the Honorable James Flory presiding.
All right. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our Zoom virtual Court of Appeals arguments here today. Thanks for your participation. Our rules are the same, regardless of whether we're in this format or in person. So that means each side here will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. We do record the proceedings as we normally would pursuant to our rules, and so it would be helpful to us if you would identify yourselves for the record as you begin your argument. First case on our calendar is in the matter of the CSRS appeal of Community Involvement Program, FSC, court file A201047. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Pari Magera from Frederickson and Byron for Relator Community Involvement Programs, FSE, or what I'll call CIP. This case is about the scope of the Department of Human Services authority to recoup funds paid to CIP for services provided by Kenesha Walker, a direct support worker providing services to a disabled Medicare waiver recipient. This is not a case about fraudulently billed services. There's no challenge that the services were actually provided to a person with disabilities who is entitled to receive them. There's no allegation of abuse of the Medicaid program. This isn't about services that didn't meet some minimum standard of care. The ALJ correctly ruled below that CIP did not do anything wrong or break any rule or regulation of the agency. Instead, this is a case about whether DHS is entitled to recoup every single cent paid to CIP for services rendered by Ms. Walker between January of 2014 and February of 2017, because unknown and functionally unknowable to CIP, Ms. Walker had been previously suspended from the Medicaid program for a two-year period that ended in 2011. DHS claims an absolute right to recover for any error it made in paying the claims. DHS's legal conclusion is flatly wrong as a matter of statutory and regulatory interpretation, and in this case, it results in a profoundly unfair outcome. That outcome can and should be reversed within the law for several reasons. First, there's no error to be corrected here. The Minnesota statutes say that DHS can recover payments made to a vendor who has been improperly paid as a result of a vendor or department error, regardless of whether the error was intentional. But that's limited to claims that were improperly paid in the first instance. These claims were not improperly paid because Ms. Walker was not under suspension during any relevant date of service.
So Ms. McGarrett, let me ask you this. How do you square that argument with subdivision one of rule 9505.2235, where the last sentence of that subpart one says, no payments shall be made to a vendor, either directly or indirectly, for services provided under a program from which the vendor had been suspended or terminated? That's past tense. And I don't think there's any dispute that Ms. Walker had been suspended and that she had not applied for reinstatement, which is dealt with in the next subpart of that same rule.
Sure. So my response to that is that if you go back down to subpart three, which talks about the recovery authority, it talks about the recovery is limited to, let's see, if a provider receives payment for a program. You're right. That's also after the suspension. Well, never mind. My point here is that this talks about under suspension, and the section that discusses reinstatement of a vendor makes no mention at all of reimbursability for claims during that period.
How can she be paid for services that were provided while she had not been reinstated when, the same rule says there shall be no payment for a person who had been suspended. I'm having a hard time getting beyond that.
Okay. Well, I think that if we talk, I think that it's helpful to look at the definition of suspension, which is DHS's own definition, which talks about a stated period of time. And so that anticipates that the suspension is a time limited sort of event. And that once your suspension expires, you're in a place that's neither suspended nor not suspended. It's something else. And that's consistent with the way DHS's own representative talked about this in her deposition, where she carefully distinguished between a provider who is suspended and one who has been not yet reinstated.
What's the significance of that distinction, though, in terms of being able to receive payment for services?
The significance of the distinction is that this talks about what a suspension is. So the significance of the distinction is that this talks about a suspension. And if the suspension is over, then it's no longer a suspension, I guess is my read of that.
Once the suspension is over, the rule, at least subpart 2, makes clear that the vendor is not automatically there's some period of time between the end of the suspension and then the vendor's eligibility to submit a claim. They have to be reinstated before they become eligible to submit a claim, right?
So I agree that subpart 2 talks about eligibility for reinstatement, but I disagree that subpart 2 talks about eligibility to submit a claim. It doesn't talk about the submission of claims at all.
So is it your position, counsel, that someone who has been suspended but who has never been reinstated is somehow eligible to submit a claim? That doesn't seem logically consistent with the rule.
Well, so I think that this rule presupposes the existence of a list of an exclusion list, and that list would be complete and that the regulated parties would be required to check it. That's why the newer or had reason to know language is important. So
the rule was adopted in 2008, at least that's what I'm looking on the revisor website right now.
Sure.
And the requirement to check the list was not adopted until much later.
Sure.
So I don't think the rule presupposes checking the list. Since the rule predates that rule requirement.
So I will point out that the rule does presuppose that there would be notice to the public of a suspension. And the reason I think that is because there's a federal regulation that talks about this that predates both this rule and the statute. And that's 42 CFR 1002.212. And that talks about how when a state makes a suspension under its Medicaid program, it must provide notice to the public. So that's where I'm getting that, is that this is a Medicaid issue, which means it's sort of intertwined with the state and federal regulations. And so this whole regulatory scheme presupposes that it is possible to know whether a person has been suspended.
So then how do you square that public notice with what you said, and I wrote this down in your introduction, that the fact that she was suspended was unknowable to your client?
Well,
and it was public as part of a public list, then it was certainly knowable.
So it wasn't knowable because there was no, so this woman was hired in 2012. There was no list at all in Minnesota until 2013. And because of the way the list was constructed, she did not actually appear on it until 2015. And so for a large chunk midway through 2015. So that's the rationale there. So that's sort of the knowability of it falls apart on both the facts and the law.
But wasn't it knowable because you're indicating that her suspension had to become public under the CFR?
Yes, but I don't think the state did that. That's the issue.
So what about the argument that the respondent makes here, Ms. McGarrah, that really irregardless of this rule or the statute, I guess the statute would still be relevant, but when your client signed its original provider agreement, it was made aware of its responsibility to know whether or not anyone it contracts with was eligible to provide services under the Medicaid program. And that even if it wasn't on the public-facing list, as it's been called here, it could have been discovered through the Medicaid Management Information System, which your client didn't do. What's your response to that?
Sure. I'm really glad you asked that question because there are two answers to it. One is that the portion of the provider agreement that's cited in the state's brief response to, or quotes a portion about the Office of the Inspector General's list of excluded individuals and entities, the LEIE, that's the federal list. And CIP did check the federal list. There's a printout from the check of the federal list in the record. And Ms. Walker never appeared on the federal list. So that part sort of falls away. As far as calling in to check MMIS, what DHS doesn't say in its brief is that in order to do that, what CIP would have had to have done is called in to provider enrollment and asked the provider enrollment call center staff to manually check every employee. And that was not required. And there was no reason for them to think that they needed to do that. It's an incredibly burdensome requirement to do that for every single person on your payroll and every contractor. And it's, I would submit, absurd to expect a provider to do that and to understand that that would be required when the law is silent on it.
Is there anything in the record indicating whether or not CIP asked Ms. Walker whether she was eligible to participate in the Medicaid program?
I don't believe the question was framed to her in that way. So I would like to be super careful not to misrepresent the record. So that is my first obligation here. So I think they asked her whether she was eligible to work. They ran her background study twice through DHS. DHS represented to providers, at least as of 2016, that the background study process would include a check of the exclusion list. And not only would it include a check of the state exclusion list at the time you submitted the background study, but it would include a check of the exclusion list on an ongoing basis via what they called wrap back searches. Now, it turns out the state didn't actually do that for CIP or for any provider during this period of time, but that was the representation.
So in the what do you believe is your strongest argument for us to consider in determining whether or not the ALJ and the commissioner through the ALJ erred here in seeking the recoupment of these funds? Because I agree with the ALJ that this is an incredibly harsh result. I'll tell you, I have scoured this record looking for a way that we can reverse this. I'm not sure the law allows that. And I want to understand what you believe your strongest argument is for us to consider in that.
I think the new or had reason to know language is the strongest. I think there's no punctuation that tells us that new or should have known or had reason to know, applies only to sanction authority as opposed to recovery. Or also there's no reason to read that condition as applying only to the second part of the sentence and not the first. So there's no sort of like grammatical reason. I also think that DHS's own understanding of the case, at least until it figured out that it could not proceed on the theory, was that that is how the rule should apply. And the way I know that is the investigation memorandum and the early filings in the contested case proceeding all keyed the time of recovery, the recovery period, to what the investigator, it turns out mistakenly, believed was the availability of the list. And so if DHS believed at the time early on that they could not or should not recover until the list became publicly available, what that tells me is that what they are reasoning is whether CIP knew or should have known of the expired suspension. And they simply did not. They definitely did not know. And for the reasons we've articulated, you know, the lack of a requirement to check the list, the lack of a list for a large portion of the time that included Ms. Walker's name at all, and the sort of existence of this wrap back process, I don't think that they should have known. So I think that is the strongest argument, and I think it's responsive to the equity. Also point out that, oh yeah, sorry.
Doesn't that language refer to the sanctions that could be imposed, the administrative sanctions, if the provider knew or had reason to know of the suspension? Isn't that what that refers to?
I don't think that the language of the regulation compels that result. So there's not a comma between those two clauses. The DHS could have put those in separate sections if they wanted to. If they wanted to make that the rule, they could have done that in a clear way. And the way that the rule is drafted today, I think that it is perfectly susceptible to the reading that the newer had reason to know language also modifies the recovery. And as I noted, I think that is actually how DHS understood the rule until it ran into a roadblock in this case.
Then the second question I have is, what do you view as the standard of review here?
Well, I mean, so this is a question of law, right? Because we're talking about interpretation of the statute and the regulations. I think that perhaps I'm running out of time, but I'd like to finish this question. Is that okay?
Sure.
You may. Okay. You can finish your answer.
So I think that the regulation's plain language is susceptible to the reading that I'm interpreting, that I'm saying, which I think means no deference to the agency. If you do determine that it is ambiguous, I think that the agency's interpretation that it adopts in its briefing today is not entitled to deference. It's not a longstanding interpretation. And I think it's inconsistent. There's evidence that it is inconsistent with its prior positions. And so I don't think that you would be required to defer to the agency's interpretation as it's configured in this particular case. Does that answer the question?
It does. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. McGarry. Your time is up. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Molly Beckius, Assistant Attorney General here on behalf of the Commissioner of Human Services. The sole issue before the court today is whether DHS can recover Medicaid funds that were paid to CIP in error. Minnesota Statute 256B.064, Subdivision 1CA, provides that DHS may obtain monetary recovery for funds improperly paid, whether the error was a result of the department or the vendor, and regardless of whether the error was intentional. It is undisputed in this case that Kenesha Walker was never reinstated as a provider, and therefore she was ineligible to bill for Medicaid funds.
So Ms. Beckius, why hasn't the commissioner sought recovery also from Ms. Walker in this case?
Your Honor, the reason that the department, and I'm not entirely privy to how the contracts work between DHS and the providers, but the money was paid to CIP from DHS. They're the ones that have the contract, and CIP then in turn pays Ms. Walker. So I believe it's because the money was actually paid to CIP, and that's who the contract is between, is DHS and CIP.
Do you agree that this is a harsh result?
DHS is sympathetic to the fact that CIP didn't have knowledge of the error, but DHS is also under obligation from federal law to ensure that Medicaid funds are paid properly, and they have an obligation to conduct surveillance and review of these payments and make sure that when they are paid improperly, they're recovered. And also the statute here specifically provides that this is the type of situation when DHS can recover these funds. It specifically says that funds are recoverable regardless of who is at fault for the error and regardless of whether the error was intentional.
So what you're saying is that you're applying a strict liability for any mistakes, no matter who makes them or why they were made.
Under Minnesota Statute 256B.064, yes, it doesn't matter who made the mistake, whether or not it was intentional. It specifically says recovery is available, whether the error was on the part of DHS or on the part of the provider. And that brings me into my first point, is that CIP invites this court to consider questions of fault, questions of what CIP could have done differently, questions of what DHS could have done differently. And these questions of fault are outside the scope of what the statute permits this court to consider. I would like to begin my argument by addressing Relator's argument that DHS cannot recover because Walker's suspension had expired. DHS's ability to recover is not premised on when Walker's suspension ended, and DHS doesn't dispute that she wasn't under suspension during the relevant time. However, DHS's ability to recover is premised on the fact that Walker was not eligible to bill for Medicaid funds because she was never reinstated as a provider. And this fact is not in dispute. Minnesota Rule 9505.2235 makes it clear that eligibility is not automatic after a suspension period ends. Specifically, the rule states that after a suspension has ended, the vendor is eligible to reapply for reinstatement. And after receiving an application for reinstatement, DHS must conduct an independent evaluation to determine whether this provider is eligible under state and federal rules.
So, Ms. Beckius, I share the same concerns as my colleagues about the inequities of this case. Would Ms. Walker have been reinstated at the end of her suspension period? I mean, it's not in the record, and I'm just wondering if this entire situation hinges on the technical error of a vendor who just neglected to apply for reinstatement, because she did perform the services and the payment was provided for services. So it's not a fraud situation. I'm just wondering if this all hinges on her technical procedural mishap. Has she been reinstated now?
She has been reinstated after the time that she worked for CIP. But again, this is...
So I'm wondering why then CIP should be punished under the statute, or if that really is the intent of this statute, to punish CIP to the tune of six figures for services that were actually provided by somebody who is currently approved to provide these services by your department.
Because she wasn't reinstated at the time that she was providing the services.
So this is a technical error on her part that is that's going to cost CIP $100,000. Is that really the position of the department?
The department's position is that it's more than a technical error, because the department is under an obligation to conduct a review of individuals after they've been suspended to make sure that they're in compliance with state and federal rules before they can bill for Medicaid funds. And DHS is under an obligation to ensure that these funds are paid out properly. So DHS is in a position where they are trying to comply with their statutory obligations in making sure that these funds were paid, that the Medicaid funds are paid out properly. So while this whole situation may have been avoided if Walker had applied earlier, the fact is that she didn't apply earlier, and she wasn't reinstated, so she wasn't eligible at the time she was billing.
But let me ask this. Let's suppose she had applied and it was a department error that she was not reinstated. Is it your position that she would still, that the results should be the same if it was an error by the department?
Are you, just to clarify your question, are you saying that
if Walker had applied for reinstatement, but DHS had not properly reinstated her, would your argument be the same?
I don't know. I can't answer what the commissioner's position would be if those were the facts. I don't know what the commissioner's position would be under those facts. So,
but she still would not be reinstated, right? Let's say that the DHS made another mistake and didn't reinstate her when they should have. Are you saying that she would still, that DHS would still be entitled to recover?
I don't know. I guess under the statute, perhaps, that if she wasn't, but I'm struggling to see what, I guess, are you saying she applied for reinstatement and DHS just never enrolled her, or?
You're right, yeah. Under that situation, would your argument be the same?
I don't know the answer to that question because those aren't the facts before us.
But the facts before us do include mistakes by DHS. I think that's a salient point. I mean, what role do the mistakes by DHS play in the punitive sanction that ends up at the feet of CIP? You didn't put her name on the list. CIP had no reason to know that she was suspended. They could have told her, you better go apply for reinstatement, otherwise we're going to be on the hook. And they didn't have that opportunity because they weren't on the list. So what role does DHS's own mistake play in this statutory scheme? Or are you absolved of any responsibility here?
So I just to answer your question, address a few of the points you made. Walker did appear on the exclusion list in 2015, but CIP still billed for her services. DHS did inform her that she needed to, that when DHS told her she was suspended, they informed her that her reinstatement would not be automatic and that she needed to reapply. Again, the statute, this is a situation where the statute permits recovery. It specifically says it doesn't matter if it's a department error. And these aren't punitive sanctions. This is just recovery of funds that were overpaid. If DHS was imposing punitive sanctions, those would be termination, suspension, fines. This is just simply recovery of funds that were overpaid.
So following up on Judge Frisch's first question, Ms. Beckius, do you agree that the record shows that the only way DHS even discovered this error was because Ms. Walker did in fact apply for reinstatement after the fact and was granted it almost immediately?
I believe, yes, the record shows that that's kind of what tipped DHS off to this and what started the investigation and why, and then led them to discover that she had been billing for several years while she wasn't enrolled as a provider.
So let me just follow up one other thing here. So if the reason for the recoupment is that she appeared on an eligibility list, but that didn't occur until June of 2015, yet the recovery period dates back over a year before that, why at a minimum isn't DHS reducing the amount of the recoupment here, if that's its reason, that she appeared on an ineligibility list, but that was over a year after they're claiming monies for recoupment? It would seem that at the very minimum here, DHS should be reducing the amount of the recoupment.
To answer your question, it's because DHS isn't recovering the money because she appeared on the exclusion list. They're recovering the money because she was never reinstated as a provider and therefore wasn't eligible to bill for Medicaid funds.
Isn't that the reason, though, that DHS provided to the ALJ as to the basis for the claim here?
The reason that DHS provided, and it's cited in the notice of agency action, which is the notice of overpayment, is under 256B.064 that the funds were paid in error and that Ms. Walker was not reinstated and therefore she wasn't enrolled in the healthcare programs and wasn't eligible to bill for Medicaid funds. Again, the CIP urges the court to consider questions of fault and equities arguments, which unfortunately for CIP just are not applicable under the statute and are outside the scope of the statute.
Well, estoppel is an equitable argument, and that can be applied in the interest of justice under certain circumstances. So there is some equitable consideration. Yes?
Yes, certainly. But in order to prevail on an estoppel argument against the state, it's a very high burden and you need to show that DHS acted with some culpability, it needs to be more than just error. And I think given the fact that the statute
Does it have to be more than an error upon which the CIP reasonably relied?
Yes, as the cases that are cited in our briefs indicate that it's a higher burden of proof than just a representation that on which CIP relied.
Which case are you pointing to? Because I was just taking a look at your arguments again.
I'm looking at Brown.
Brown's your best case?
Yes, and the Misaba case. In both of those cases, the government did make representations to the individual, but that wasn't enough to prevail on an estoppel argument. And again, it's questionable whether DHS even did make representations that Ms. Walker was eligible. The fact that she didn't appear on an exclusion list is not an affirmative representation that she was eligible. The fact that she cleared background studies is not a representation. Those background studies are under Chapter 245C, which addressed someone's eligibility to work with vulnerable populations. And especially since the statute explicitly provides that recovery is available, whether it's an error on DHS's part or the vendor's part, this isn't a situation where justice requires that estoppel should be applied against the state.
So how culpable does the government have to be before the estoppel applies against the state? What's the litmus test?
I don't know the exact standard of what that would be, but in this case, there isn't any culpability. Whether or not, I mean, it's questionable whether DHS even made representations to CIP that Walker was eligible. And as a provider, CIP entered into a provider agreement and was aware of their obligations to ensure that the people they were working with were eligible. So CIP had responsibility as well in this case. And in summary, it's undisputed that Ms. Walker was not eligible. The Medicaid funds were paid to CIP in error and summary disposition was appropriate. Thank you.
Well, I do have one question for you, Ms. Beckius. The commissioner didn't act on the order and recommendation of the ALJ, and I think that's okay under the statute, which allows them to do that. But by not acting on it, they've adopted the reasoning and analysis of the ALJ. And the ALJ on pages 6 and 7 of his order seems to say that the recoupment here was mandatory, which is contrary to the statute, which says it's discretionary, they may recoup. So why isn't that alone an abuse of discretion based upon a misapplication of the law that would at a minimum require the DHS to do its job, review the order and exercise discretion as to whether it should collect or not? It seems like it skipped a step here.
I just want to pull up the part of the order that you're talking about, page 6 and 7.
Yeah. You know, right at the top of page 7, it says the department shall recover the amount of payment, mandates the department to recover the money paid. That's an interpreting this no or had reason to know language, but it seems like the ALJ assumed there was no discretion there, which is contrary to this statute. And the commissioner adopted that analysis by its failure to act on the order.
In this case, it's the commissioner's position that the recovery was discretionary, and so I guess I'm not sure the answer to your question, because I think it's outside the scope of what DHS is seeking to recover in this case under these circumstances.
Thank you. And I know, I think there's a footnote in your brief where you've kind of addressed the same issue. So, all right, Ms. Magara, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish.
Wonderful, thank you. I just want to hit a couple of points here. One is the strict liability issue. I'll point out that DHS's CSRS division actually attempted to promulgate rules that would impose strict liability for any nonconformity with a contractual or regulatory requirement, and those rules didn't go through. As I look at my brief, I realize I did not put in a footnote to that order from the OAH, but it is in my summary disposition briefing, so it should be available. I may have even attached the order as an exhibit. I apologize for that oversight in my brief. Listening to Judge Frisch, I wonder if perhaps the error here was Ms. Walker's and not either the department or the vendors here, and such that the error authority does not, the error recovery authority doesn't apply at all. That strikes me as one possibility. It will point out that Ms. Walker was actually reinstated by DHS, that DHS did not seek to recover any funds from her, nor did CIP. So the money that came in from DHS was paid in large measure to Ms. Walker. So the money had come and gone. So the idea that this is just sort of removing an overpayment or ill-gotten gains by CIP is just not accurate. That money came in and went out as required by their arrangement with her.
Ms. McGarrett, can you answer the question that, or maybe address the question that I posed to Ms. Beckius? How culpable does the government have to be for an estoppel to apply? Is there what in your view is the litmus test, if any?
So I think that, you know, what we've got are some guideposts, right, in the case law. And this is really different than the Brown case, right? Because in that case, there was an unambiguous regulatory requirement. So the idea that this provider, so that was a case where there's a prior authorization requirement for certain kinds of services. That was clearly in the rule, no dispute that that was the rule. And the provider either didn't know, or maybe his staff was casually told by, you know, like, provider services or the equivalent at the time, this is the case from 1985, that prior authorization wouldn't be required. And that's not the same kind of an affirmative representation like we've got here. Because what we've got here is the statements about the rat back like studies in the DHS background study program and the absence of Ms. Walker's name on the list. And I know that the state's position is that a party is not entitled to assume that the background or that the exclusion list is complete, but that strikes me as a poor position on the facts and the law.
Thank you.
And then I wanted to just briefly address the sort of what is the impact of this case going forward. And I think that the impact of this case going forward on DHS's ability to do its job to safeguard Medicaid funds is pretty minimal, particularly if this is a new or had reason to know kind of reasoning. And the reason I say that is because there is now a statutory requirement that both requires DHS to create a list. So that's both a statutory requirement at the state level, in addition to the federal regulatory requirement to give public notice that I mentioned earlier. I think that's been in place since the 90s. And there's now a statutory requirement for providers to actually check the list. So new or should have known is awfully easy to apply when that's the legal landscape that we're working with. Because then a provider's failure to check the list is easy to work with. So I think that this has fairly little impact going forward on DHS's ability to do their job. If there's no other questions, I can be done and save you all a minute.
I note that there are no other questions. So thank you. And thanks you to both counsel. Your arguments were very helpful today. Your briefing has been helpful on the issue. We will take the matter under advisement. The case is now submitted to the court and we'll issue a decision on the matter within 90 days.